You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear about the growing practice of training dogs to protect livestock and other farm animals from predators like coyotes and wolves.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions was in Wisconsin this week to talk about law enforcement's response to opioid addiction.
The state's Department of Justice released a report with more details about the March 22nd mass shooting in Rothschild, Wisconsin, near Wausau.
And the head of two troubled juvenile correctional facilities in Wisconsin has stepped down.
Robert Menster joins us now for a look at these stories and more. He's a senior statewide editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thanks.
Well, let's start with Attorney General Jeff Sessions coming to Wisconsin, Green Bay, earlier this week. What brought him to the state?
Yes, so Sessions spoke to the annual conference of the National Alliance for Drug Endangered Children, which was in Green Bay this year. So he was here to speak about the effects of the opioid epidemic on children and families in particular. This is something that, you know, USA Today Network Wisconsin has done a lot of reporting on. I know Wisconsin Public Radio has done a lot of reporting on. There are a lot of ways that the opioid epidemic is being felt here. There's a spike in the number of children taken away from their families, a shortage of foster parents sort of across Wisconsin as a result. And so, I mean, the issues are very real. It's the sort of thing that the alliance is concerned with.
And here's a listen to Attorney General Sessions talking about kind of the ripple effects of opioid abuse.
We cannot accept this. Family breakup, job loss, bankruptcy, homelessness, college degrees forfeited, jail, even death. It's not something this nation can sustain.
And Rob, what did the Attorney General say when it came to the approach, what needs to be done to tackle the problem?
Well, so just being real, he spoke for about 20 minutes, and it was rather, he spoke in more generalities. He touched on prevention of, preventing abuse in the first place, on enforcing drug laws, cracking down on dealers, and of the treatment piece. But there is a tension here. His policy agenda is he has forever been a sort of old school hardliner on drug policies, and that is the way that he is running the Department of Justice. So he's issued formal guidance to district attorneys to seek the maximum penalty in drug cases, which reverses an Obama administration directive that they didn't have to always go for the maximum. And he's opposed to various, marijuana legalization, other sorts of drug policies. So what his policy focuses on is incarceration. So this is the piece where there is some controversy, or at least some criticism of his speech as somebody who is more focused on putting people in jail and less on sort of dealing with treatment or the effects of addiction.
Want to move on to a story from the State Department of Justice and one in your part of the state. Back in March, of course, that horrible mass shooting in the Wausau area, 4 people and the perpetrator died. A new report came out this week. This is from the state's Department of Justice, part of the state law requiring an outside investigation of any police-involved shooting. Can you talk about what we learned from this report?
Right. So the law exists so that police departments don't investigate themselves when there is a shooting by a police officer. And in this case, the shooter, Neng Mai Vang, who shot and killed 4 people, including a police officer in this Wausau area incident on the end of March, March 22nd, he was shot and killed by police at the end of a lengthy standoff that was some 3 hours long. So the state's report, it found that officers acted lawfully. They did not violate the law in when they shot Vang. To be honest, I don't think anyone thought that they did. He was quite clearly was a threat, and he was armed. He was threatening to further violence. But the other thing that comes with these with these reports is they released hundreds of pages of documents on their investigation into what happened, images from the day and from the scenes of the crime, because Vang went from place to place, and as well as audio of 911 calls. He spent several hours on the phone with negotiators and 911 operators during the standoff. So there's a lot of very hard to look at, but still important details about what happened that day that came out with this report.
In some way, reliving a very frightening day. Is this something that's still very much on the minds of people in the Wausau area?
Yeah, I think without a doubt it is. So, you know, a police officer was killed, and his colleagues, sort of live with that. A divorce attorney. This shooting happened because this man, Neng Mai Vang, targeted his wife, with whom he was going through a divorce. He wanted to kill her. Her coworkers sheltered her, and as a result, Vang killed two of her coworkers and then went to her divorce lawyer and killed the attorney and then killed the police officer outside his own apartment. So the issues around domestic violence, public safety, policing, absolutely it brings home the stakes of these matters.
We're talking to Rob Mentzer from the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. It's our weekly look at some of the big stories in state news. Rob, another criminal justice-related story, going back to Lincoln Hills and the Copper Lake Juvenile Correctional Institutions. There have been some high-profile departures from jobs around the state, and this is another one. The director there at Lincoln Hills has stepped down, Wendy Peterson. Can you talk about her resignation and her time there?
Sure. So Peterson, no one quite says this, but it's easy to connect the dots. So in June, a federal judge issued a scathing ruling calling out mismanagement and abuses at Lincoln Hills. This, of course, has been the subject of lengthy, investigations, multiple lawsuits, and individual cases of abuse that have surfaced over the past year and a half, I guess, since the news of the investigation became public. So Peterson, who was not the superintendent for much of that period, but she has been the superintendent this year. One of the things that the judge in the June ruling was specifically critical of was use and overuse of pepper spray and solitary confinement in the facility, which these are kids. Breaking this afternoon, is a new report finding that guards used pepper spray on these teenagers at Lincoln Hills more than 100 times in 6 months, including 12 times against one teen inmate in that period. The news that Peterson would no longer be superintendent, she returns to her former position, a lower-level position as education director, came one day before the release of this state report. It feels like you can sort of connect the dots that these things are related.
It speaks to, I guess, the difficulty in changing things at a place like Lincoln Hills, retraining in the use of pepper spray and when to use solitary confinement is not something, I guess, that happens overnight. But
sure.
The problems that were initially flagged still seem to be going on.
Sure. I mean, I'm not an expert in this, and one wants to be a bit careful. Like pepper spray, it exists for a reason, and it is used in situations as a non-lethal way to subdue someone. But the report did say that pepper spray was used for some infractions like inmates who wouldn't remove their hands from the feeding slot in their cells. So it certainly looks like there were uses that went well beyond just a sort of narrow public safety use.
Then I want to move on to a non-criminal justice-related story. Rob, Wisconsin will be represented at a world championship for arm wrestling in Hungary. Can you tell us about this story?
I love this story, yes. Shauna Feist is 39 years old. She's from Plover by Stevens Point there, and she is a champion arm wrestler. She has a great story. She won her division at the American Arm Sport Association's National Championship in Battle Creek, Michigan. And so, yeah, she's going to Budapest to compete in the World Arm Wrestling Championships. A great thing about Feist is she is legally blind. She has all but 20% of vision in one eye, is so she can't see well, and she says that it gives her an advantage that she sits down to arm wrestle and her opponent might try to kind of get in her head or give her the mean mug, and it doesn't matter. This is what she said. It doesn't affect her.
Well, we'll be watching for the results. And Shauna herself is scheduled to talk to us 2 weeks from today, I think, after she gets back from those world championships. So looking forward to that. And Rob, always looking forward to talking to you. Thanks for joining us again.
All right. Thank you.
Robert Mentzer is a senior statewide editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. He joins us every Friday at this time for a look at this week's biggest news stories.
Predators like wolves, coyotes, and sometimes bears are responsible for millions of dollars in livestock losses each year nationally.
So for decades, ranchers and farmers have enlisted dogs to protect their animals from those kind of attacks.
Julie Young joins us now. She's field station leader at the USDA National Wildlife Research Center in Logan, Utah. Julie, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, how long has this practice of having dogs protect livestock been around?
It's been around for quite a long time. Some of the data suggests it's been around for about 5,000 years in parts of Europe.
So it goes back a ways. Do we know what kinds of breeds are typically used now and I guess also in the past?
Yes, there are 33 breeds used globally. And then, of course, a lot of people use mixed breeds as well. But of those, there were a few that became popular in the United States starting in the late 70s, early 1980s, and those were things like the Great Pyrenees and the Maraima.
And in terms of what the benefit is, why use dogs when there might be other methods that are available? What's the advantage there?
Right. Well, dogs offer something that some of the other non-lethal tools to manage depredation losses can't offer, and that is that they can respond. A lot of the other things, like turboflagellary, which is used quite a lot in Wisconsin and is very effective too, works well, but it doesn't have that ability to adapt to the situation on hand.
What is turboflagellary?
Oh,
did I hear you right?
So turboflagellary, I guess the best way to describe it for listeners is to envision flag football flags, something that you'd wear around your waist. And you can hang that around a pen or, usually somewhere where maybe you're having calves be born or lambs be born. And for some reason, to canids, especially wolves and coyotes, it's scary. And we call it turboflagellary because we'll often electrify it. So if they try to test it and break through that visual barrier, they get zapped and then are reminded it's scary.
Oh, wow. I've never heard of that. So that's something that's also in common practice in Wisconsin and other places?
Yes, it's becoming more common. Again, it also started historically in Europe where people would carry these lines of this flagellary, not electrified since people were carrying it, to funnel wolves when they would trap them during hunts. And so it kind of got adapted in the United States a little over a decade ago to be used to, instead of bring wolves and, trap them in to keep them out, because, again, it's that visual barrier that scares them. And so, for instance, in Wisconsin, the Wildlife Services is actively working with ranchers to hang flagellary when they have calving going on.
But that doesn't work for everything you were saying.
No, it works really well against canids. There's a little bit of evidence that it might also work against mountain lions, but bears tend to kind of ignore it. Now, bears are affected by electric fencing, so turboflagellary may work sort of indirectly because of the turbo part, but just general electric fencing works better against bears.
Now, here in Wisconsin, I don't think we have so much a problem with mountain lions, although I have heard there have been isolated mountain lions maybe reported, but not really a problem as far as I understand it for livestock. What are the predators that need to be addressed in Wisconsin and the Midwest?
In Wisconsin, I would say probably one of the biggest conflict issues is wolves, and then, of course, coyotes. I don't know what the data look like for your state on black bears, but elsewhere black bears can also cause a lot of conflict with livestock. But those three species are probably the priority species. One of the things about wolves in Wisconsin is that they don't, you know, they come into conflict a lot of times with livestock, but also there seems to be a lot of issues with hunting dogs and hunting dogs being killed or attacked by wolves. And so, you know, livestock guard dogs can be really effective, but people do have to consider if they're in an area where maybe wolves are less fearful of dogs already for some reason. Now, hunting dogs and guard dogs work very differently, so it's not to say that guard dogs wouldn't work in Wisconsin because of the high losses of hunting dogs, but, you know, it's just something to think about as far as if you're a rancher there considering using guard dogs and you haven't yet. Some do get killed or attacked by dogs, I mean, by wolves. We've seen that in states like Idaho and other western states. But for the most part, they work really well in areas with wolves.
Now, what kind of training do guard dogs need? I imagine they don't, there are some instincts involved, but I imagine there's maybe a lengthy training process also.
You know, they don't need too much training. The big part of the training, it is instinctive. The big part of the training is giving them a few commands so that they will respond to you or come to you, but not so much that they think of themselves as pets to you. You know, you want them to bond. So the biggest training is getting them to bond with the livestock. Most sheep, you know, the technique is most popular with sheep producers in the United States, and they often put puppies in with lambs so that they grow up together, and that really creates that bond. Now, once you have a few guard dogs, it's really easy to get new puppies and just have them learn the older dogs. But to start out, there's a lot of resources out there, both online and books, to help with the minimal amount of training that is needed to make sure that the dogs are bonded and, but yet, somewhat responsive to humans, and especially in ways that aren't dangerous to humans.
We're talking to Julie Young right now, field station leader at the USDA National Wildlife Research Center in Logan, Utah, talking about the practice of using dogs to protect livestock and other farm animals. We have an article up about this by WisContext right now on the Central Time Facebook page. And Julie, there could be, with dogs that aren't maybe socialized all the way or fully trained, some dangers inherent in this idea, including, you know, if someone's walking by, they're hiking. What about the dog being aggressive to people or being aggressive in situations where it's not appropriate?
Mm-hmm. And we do consider that quite a bit. We've been looking at different breeds of guard dogs and their effectiveness, especially against wolves out west. And one of the things that we did when identifying which breeds to use was of the 33 that are used globally, we didn't select any that are in any way used anymore, you know, today as any sort of attack dog or fighting dog or anything like that. And so I think the big thing is just first and foremost for people to be aware of who they're buying the dogs from or where they're getting their dogs from and making sure that they're from working lineages, that these are dogs born and raised and bred from working dogs that are, you know, out there with livestock. Most of the dog breeds in the United States have worked with sheep, but in Europe, a lot of the dogs work both with sheep and cattle. But there is a little bit of nuances, you know, in how that works. It works a little bit differently because sheep are more likely to herd together, which makes the dog's job a lot easier. And so, again, just making sure that, you know, people look at which breeds work best with cattle and, you know, which, and if they've maybe come from lineages that have already worked with cattle, that will make it a lot more effective. So a lot of it is just knowing the background of the dog and then knowing the background of how to train that dog. And we definitely, a lot of people get, you know, a little fearful, well, not fearful, but they think that they can't interact with the dog because then the dog might become too domestic or too pet-like. And in a few cases, we have that where the dog wants to spend more time at the house than out with the livestock. But in most cases, if you bond it as a puppy, they want, that's their litter mates. And so that's who they want to spend time with. And being able to pet the dog and give it a few commandments, so if there is a hiker walking by, it knows you know, if anything, it might bark and walk up and you pet it on the head and then it goes back to the sheep or cattle. That's how you want to train the dog to behave.
Right, and you also want this job. It is a job to be humane for the dogs. And you were talking about some fatalities with wolves. And I can imagine if you're talking about guard dogs out west where there are grizzlies, that doesn't seem like a fair matchup between a dog and a grizzly. So what do you do in a situation like that?
Right. So there's a few things that people do. One is a lot of times people use more than one guard dog. So having them kind of act as a pack will really help both protect them and be more alert to the threats that are out there. Obviously, three dogs can do better than one. But, you know, when you're on a private ranch, sometimes that's not possible because of the size of the area. If you have too many dogs, they might get bored and start to roam. And one of the biggest threats, actually, to guard dogs is getting hit by a car because they roam. Mm. or they cross a street because the sheep have crossed the street. And so so that's, you know, something to consider. But, you know, grizzly bears, at least the few states where we've worked with guard dogs, I mean, they can, again, attack or even kill guard dogs, but they're pretty scared off by the bark. Wolves are a little bit more of a problem. And one of the things that we recommend, both for the road problem and for the wolf problem, is spay or neutering the dogs. For one thing, then you don't have a lot of unwanted puppies being born, or you don't have a pregnant female that can't, you know, she can't keep up anymore with your livestock because she's nursing or about to give birth. And for another thing, they don't roam as far when they're spayed or neutered. And so you kind of lower their risk of encountering wolves without their litter mates, you know, their other guard dogs. And also they won't roam, and so they won't cross as many roads.
Julie, thanks a lot for joining us today and filling us in.
Great. Thank you for having me.
That was Julie Young, field station leader at the USDA National Wildlife Research Center in Logan, Utah. And we've been talking about the practice of using dogs to protect livestock and other farm animals. And you can find a WisContext article about that topic over on the Central Time Facebook page.
Now, Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark submitted his resignation yesterday afternoon. The now former sheriff of Milwaukee County has been a controversial figure, both in Wisconsin and on the national stage, for his opinions on police-community relations and his early and enthusiastic support of President Trump.
Wisconsin Public Radio reporter Chuck Kornbach joins us now to talk about that resignation and what it could mean for Clark moving forward. Chuck, welcome back.
Thank you. Hello.
So what reasons did Sheriff Clark give for his resignation?
Well, he didn't say a whole lot in his official resignation letter to the county clerk yesterday at about 3:15. He just was very matter-of-fact, didn't give any reasons. A later statement that he put out suggested that he was resigning for other opportunities that he will announce perhaps as soon as late next week after the Labor Day holiday.
And in terms of the expectedness of this, it was a very short notice initially and a pretty short statement afterwards. Did anyone see this coming?
Well, I guess if you look at the signs afterwards, maybe you could see it. But the county executive, Milwaukee County Executive Chris Abley, said yesterday he was very surprised. He was sitting in a meeting and has started getting many texts that he figured something was up. And then he learned that this was it, that the county clerk, George Christensen, said that all of a sudden a key aide to Clark came in and hand-delivered the resignation note, so there was no advance word to the county clerk. And I think it's by and large a surprise as to the exact timing of it, but there were signs that when Clark announced back in May that he was leaving for a job with Homeland Security, and then the Trump administration never confirmed that, and Clark said, well, okay, I'll stay as sheriff. There were signs then that, well, maybe that wouldn't work out all that well if you said you were leaving and then you never didn't get that approved officially by your potential boss. So there were potential signs, but the timing, you know, was out of the blue.
So it seems possible. He used the word opportunity. Is there speculation that he is leaving for a job with the Trump administration, maybe a different one than he referenced earlier on?
Well, there could be a job with the Trump administration. Politico is reporting that as a possibility. Others are suggesting that, well, you know, there were some jail deaths at the Milwaukee County Jail that Sheriff Clark runs, and there was an inquest that recommended charges in one case. Milwaukee County District Attorney John Chisholm has not issued any charges yet. This was several months ago. Has not issued any charges yet, but the potential, if Clark would stay in the public sector and take a job with the Trump administration or try to, it's possible we might see some sort of decision from the DA. But, you know, he could wind up with in Washington or elsewhere in the federal government. Some of his critics might just say, we're happy to have him gone from here, and whatever he takes, a job he takes in Washington would be less of a controversy than having him as county sheriff.
And Chuck, before we let you go, what is the reaction in Milwaukee County?
Well, it's by and large from the public officials, they're pleased that he's going. Executive Abley was smiling yesterday during much of his news conference. Alderman Bob Donovan of the city of Milwaukee, though, today said that Clark, whether you like him or not, he had the guts to take a stand. So he's got several statements from conservative public officials praising Clark's work.
Chuck, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Chuck Kornbeck is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News based in Milwaukee with us there to tell us about Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark's sudden resignation yesterday.
Now we turn our attention to Washington, D.C. Over the last few weeks, more news has emerged in the ongoing investigation into Russian meddling during the 2016 presidential campaign and whether or not members of the Trump campaign potentially colluded with Russia in some way. Since his victory in November, these allegations have followed the president and members of his campaign, like son-in-law Jared Kushner.
Now the investigation has zeroed in on former campaign manager and pro-Russia lobbyist Paul Manafort. While the investigation continues, tensions between the two countries grow, with both the U.S. and Russia demanding the other close some foreign consulates.
Lowell Barrington joins us now. He's an associate professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. Lowell, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, there's a lot, as there has been all along here, a lot of different news items and threads floating out here. What are you focused on most as news emerges about this Russia investigation?
It certainly has been an exciting week trying to keep up with the stories as they have been breaking. I think one of the things that this week has shown, and it's I think not a surprise to a lot of us who've focused more on the Russia side of this from the start, is that it seems to be focusing a little bit more now on the issue of the money trail and following the possibility of financial, not only connections, but financial misdeeds by those in the Trump campaign or the president himself. And I think that's one of those things that for a while now, many of us who study the region, when we started to hear references, for example, to Cyprus and countries that are known as significant locations for Russian money laundering, that there had been a suspicion at some point that this would turn in a more of a financial direction than a collusion direction.
Yeah, some people had pointed toward Special Counsel Robert Mueller. As he put together his team, there were people who specialized in financial fraud, international money laundering kinds of things. Is that a sign to you that, yeah, this is part of what's going on here as far as the investigation?
I think that was a sign very early on as he started putting together his team. I think more recently the news, and again, at least reports, that he is now working not only with the New York State Attorney General, which is an interesting topic to talk about, but the IRS's Criminal Investigation Unit, which really, again, also focuses specifically on financial crimes, including money laundering and tax evasion.
We'll get more into that New York Attorney General issue, but let's talk about Cyprus, because that's not, I think, something that a lot of people have had front and center here. What is the Cyprus connection when it comes to money flowing out of Russia and into gray areas around the world?
Right. Even in the early 1990s already, Cyprus had been a place that a lot of money was flowing out of Russia and into banks in Cyprus, and it didn't make a lot of sense in a lot of ways, except for a lot of this money was let's say, shady money from Russia that was, by most accounts, being laundered through those banks to try to kind of clean up and then on its way back to Russia or into investments in the West, in Europe, for example, or the United States. So there are connections still to Cyprus by a number of top Russian officials, and there are also questions about even some of the people like Paul Manafort and having potential ties to banks on Cyprus.
Yeah, can you talk more about that? We've got the connection between Russian government officials slash organized crime elements in some ways and this island in the Mediterranean, Cyprus. What are the tendrils that people are looking at potentially between people in the United States, people involved in the Trump campaign or the Trump organization?
Well, I think there are ties of actual officials who had held top positions related to banks in Cyprus in the United States, but also the use of Cyprus as a location to try to basically develop shell companies to put money into. And this is something that Paul Manafort has been looked into in particular in terms of some of his investments and the efforts to use shell businesses to kind of take money, buy real estate with cash, and then use those companies to essentially buy back the real estate and kind of clean up that money through, or at least get loans to cover the real estate to kind of clean that money back up. And so certainly he has some concerns, or should have some concerns, about the investigation taking this turn in a financial direction.
And Paul Manafort was, for a brief while, the campaign manager for the successful Trump campaign. And it seems like he is the center of the investigation in some ways now. There was a raid on his house recently, and now people are talking about notes he took, apparently, at the meeting with Donald Trump Jr. and people from Russia, proxies maybe. What do we know about the investigation, again, given that a lot of this is behind closed doors?
Well, we know that the June 9th, 2016 meeting has become much more central to the investigation, not only because who was involved, and including on the Russian side, but that what had been talked about by the White House as this being a really minor meeting that didn't lead to anything, and Jared Kushner didn't stay very long, and Paul Manafort was playing around in his phone. You know, we now know, in fact, he was taking notes on his phone, and so there are, again, interesting reports, at least, about some of the things possibly in those notes that have made, again, probably at least made Robert Mueller take an even closer look at that meeting than he would have already.
And you mentioned earlier a big development, the Mueller investigation working with New York's attorney general. And people have been pointing toward the pardon of Sheriff Joe Arpaio earlier this week as a sign that, hey, maybe President Trump would pardon others, people involved in his campaign. Well, if there's a state element to this, the president can pardon federal crimes. He can't pardon anything happening at the state level. Is that right?
That's correct. And I think that there are a few things about Eric Schneiderman in particular, including that the New York Attorney General's office has significant power in the area of financial crimes, very broad subpoena powers, for example, partly just because New York City is essentially the financial capital of the world in many ways, and that has made the Attorney General of New York develop a very strong and deep staff, including even recently hiring some additional people who had been looking into Donald Trump and real estate deals in the past as additional people for his team. So he has been working on this for a little while. I think the reports have just come out, but it seems pretty clear that in fact, Mueller and Schneiderman had been cooperating for a while now. So the pardon issue is an important one. You can't, as president, pardon someone from a state crime, and I don't think the New York governor would have any interest in pardoning Trump administration officials anytime soon. So that is an important piece of the story. But it's also that threat of not being able to be pardoned could be used to put pressure on Paul Manafort, for example, to testify in more detail than he might have otherwise been willing to do, because he now is not safe potentially from these state charges.
Lowell Barrington is with us now to talk about the latest political implications in the ongoing Russia probe. He's an associate professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Marquette University.
And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. What do you think of the ongoing Russia investigation? Do you think it's necessary, or do you agree with President Trump that it's a political witch hunt? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation about the latest into the investigation into Russian interference during the 2016 presidential race with Lowell Barrington. He's an associate professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Marquette University.
You can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on the Russia probe? What do you think the outcome will be once the investigation concludes? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Lowell, a lot of the starting point on this was the Russian interference or attempts to interfere in the 2016 election campaign, hacking the Democratic National Committee and Clinton campaign emails. We're seeing more and more news about efforts to hack into election machine companies and things like that. Is this a common instrument of Russian foreign policy, not just in the U.S., but in other countries, to use this sort of cyber effort to interfere with elections?
It has been, both in Europe and in other countries, that they have used computer cyber attacks as political tools in the past. They have launched viruses, for example, against Ukraine during the battle for eastern and southern Ukraine. But they also are using things that are not as, bad sounding as cyber attacks by simply having people work on posting things in comment sections, for example, on websites and posting misleading or completely incorrect stories to social media threads as well. And I think that's something we shouldn't underestimate, that certainly the hacking into records and attempts at least to poke at voting machines and see what they can get into in terms of at least the registration records, if not the machines themselves. I think those are concerns, but there was probably at least as much or more damage done by the spread of misinformation via social media.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Joan is with us in Winona, Minnesota. Joan, hi.
Yes, hi.
What do you think, Joan?
Well, I really believe that where there's smoke, there's fire. And there has been a lot of smoke around the Russia investigation and what the Trump folks did leading up to the election. And I absolutely want all the investigations to go forward, because I think not only is the president probably involved, but also many people in his administration, including the vice president. And we need to know the truth about what folks did relative to our common enemy, the Russians, to perhaps swing this election or even just attempt to swing it.
Joan, thanks for the call. But we don't necessarily have the fire part of that equation, do we, Lowell, about whether members of the Trump team had actively colluded with Russians in those interference efforts we were talking about. That, at least from what we know publicly, we don't have the proverbial smoking gun on that.
I think that's largely correct, although one of the things, again, about the June 9th meeting that was so important was it appears to have at least been set up under the idea that there would be information about the Clinton campaign given to members of the Trump campaign. And the fact that they took that meeting in the first place showed at least an interest or even intent to work with Russia or Russian interests in that way. So I think there's something maybe between a only smoke and no fire, and maybe some at least smoldering coals a bit or something there that in fact really does demand further investigation. I would say I think we don't know nearly as much about the extent of President Trump or Vice President Pence's direct involvement in these as we do about members of his campaign team. And it's certainly possible that the president was not as directly involved as some might think, because in fact people wanted to shelter him or perhaps didn't even really trust him to be involved in those kind of meetings if they did take place with that intent. And that's where he has not helped himself by in fact engaging in activities that at least opened the door to discussions of obstruction of justice and certainly by leading the investigation to at least open doors into the economic and finance questions.
Joan, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Joan saying there, Lowell, that the investigation should go on. It is going on, actually, investigations, the Mueller one and then one in each House of Congress. There has been talk about the idea that President Trump might fire some people, might attempt to stop the Mueller investigation. Do you think that's likely?
I think politically it would be very difficult. I think even the Republican members of Congress, I thought the Senate, for example, Republican leadership right before the recess by engaging in a tactic to essentially stay in session rather than go into official recess to prevent him from, you know, doing different kinds of things with appointment powers that would have opened the door to removing Mueller. I think that was a very important sign that Republican leadership in the House and Senate really don't have the stomach for Robert Mueller being fired. I would add, though, that all of the things that have been said so far about Eric Schneiderman, there are a few other things, and one of them is that by working with him, Mueller is providing him information, and they're clearly sharing information. So even if somehow Mueller were removed, this additional work now with the IRS and with people like Eric Schneiderman in New York do kind of prevent the investigation from being entirely shut down, even if Mueller is somehow removed.
Now, there have been accusations that some people, Democrats in particular, are slipping into sort of a Russophobia, a new Cold War mentality, exaggerating the threat of Russia. Do you think there's something to that?
Well, I think, I mean, the term Cool War has been floated and the risk of sliding into that. I think in many ways we are already there. I think from even before the election, relations with Russia had certainly not been as positive as they had been 10 or 15 years ago, and some of that has to do with actions by Russia. Certainly the involvement in the campaign is an issue, but we need to keep in mind and remember that the issue of Russian sanctions, and Russia certainly was hoping President Trump's election would have created a situation to eliminate those sanctions, that was because of Russia's actions on their own end with countries like Ukraine or even activities involving Syria. So I think for quite a while now there has been growing tensions, and I think President Trump clearly hoped, and one might say for valid reasons, hoped that the relations between Russia and the United States would improve. I think on the Russian side, there's been a lot of unhappiness with what they have been able to get out of the Americans in terms of improved relations, and the latest incidents and debates over things like consulates just shows that, in fact, this is not something we're removing yet in any kind of way toward really positive relations.
As we start to wrap up, what are you watching for next as these investigations go forward?
I think, again, for me, one of the really interesting sides of the events of the last couple of weeks has just been how clear this is now just focusing not only anymore on things like collusion and even things like obstruction of justice, but really a following the money investigation. And I think that one of the things that hasn't been talked a lot about yet in working with the New York State Attorney General is that when the president files federal tax forms, there are also state tax forms, and there would be state tax forms in New York. So again, one of the things that could happen is he could run afoul of tax laws at the federal level, but those would also be, if he failed to disclose things, for example, a state issue in New York as well. And that's something that even if we want to go down this path of imagining a scenario where the president resigns and we now have a President Pence, that Mike Pence can't pardon Donald Trump either for New York crimes. And so I think that we need to really have in mind how important this move is to create a state level or at least foster and deepen a state level investigation to parallel that going on at the federal level.
Lowell, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob, and thank you, Veronica.
That's Lowell Barrington, Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. He joined us today for a look at the ongoing probe into Russia's meddling in the 2016 presidential campaign.